Welcome to the latest issue of JAMA Evidence. I'm Gordon Guyatt from McMaster University, and I'm going to be interviewing John Attia, who led a user's guide to genetic association studies, one of the important user's guides in a particularly innovative field. He's a professor in Newcastle, and he has been active in the field and so well qualified for this particular user's guide. John, welcome.
Thank you.
Can I start off by asking you, what were we trying to achieve with this particular user's guide?
So I think readers probably have seen over the last few years more and more genetic association studies being published. Initially, they were just candidate gene associations where people had some hypotheses about which gene should be involved in a particular disease outcome. And so people would look at variants in that particular gene in relation to disease outcome. And then more recently, these genome-wide association studies where basically microarrays or these slides the size of a normal microscope slide where you can genotype millions of genetic variants in one go on a person. So these genome-wide association studies look at millions of genetic variants in relation to disease. And people have been wondering how to read those and what are the criteria for validity in those studies, and particularly how they apply to clinical practice. And I think that's what we've tried to focus on in those users' guides.
And the way I remember it, the initial user's guides were more specific studies rather than the genome-wide association. Is that right?
Yes, so that's how the field went as well. Before the Human Genome Project, people basically looked at specific genetic variants in genes that they already knew were associated with disease, whereas these genome-wide association studies are more agnostic and probably are a better approach because, in fact, we have a very poor handle on what biological pathways play a role in which diseases. So by screening the entire genome, new hits have come up that have shed light on which biological pathways are involved in disease.
So by casting a wide net, we pick up things that we weren't even suspecting. Do I understand it correctly?
That's exactly right. Yes, pathways that we didn't suspect were part of a disease process are now showing up in these genome-wide association studies.
So people see results of the genome-wide association studies. What insights can they hope to gain from our user's guides?
So at the moment, the user's guide is more to help people interpret the results. And the results at this point, I think, are still very much of interest to research clinicians. What we're finding is that the odds ratios associated with a genetic variant and a disease, at least most complex diseases like diabetes, obesity, asthma, those sorts of things, are still very, very tiny. So the odds ratios are, you know, 1.05 to 1.2, 1.4, that sort of range. So they are not powerful enough yet to use by themselves in prognosis of disease or diagnosis. At this point, they seem to be most useful in terms of shedding light on which pathways are involved and helping basic scientists go back and look at the biology and the mechanism of disease. There are a few complex diseases, like diabetes, for example, where the genetic variants do seem to have a much larger effect. And in those settings, potentially we can start using the genes as prognostic factors for the risk of developing disease. And what they do there is use tens to hundreds, sometimes even thousands of genes together to make up a polygenic risk score.
So as I recall it from the first time we tried this, polygenic risk scores did not even appear, or at least not appear prominently in the guide. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. They are getting a bit better, but it's still a bit disappointing. What we find is that if you look at examples at the AUC for predicting the development of diabetes or the development of a stroke, the normal risk factors, it will give you an AUC of 0.7, 0.75, something like that. And even when you add tens or hundreds of genes to that risk score, the AUC still goes up only, 0.01 or 0.02. So it's been disappointing in that way. But where the benefit has come is in highlighting new pathways to target with new therapeutics. So just as an example, there's been GWAS studies of high cholesterol. And one of the hits there was PCSK9, which is a new protein. It's a hepatic receptor, and that wasn't a target previously. And between the time that it was identified in a GWAS and the time that a monoclonal antibody was developed and tested in an RCT and published in New England Journal, it was, I think, 6 years' time. So that's amazingly quick compared to what drug development used to take.
So just to make sure that everybody listening is clear, GWA is genome-wide association, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And you mentioned AUC. Not everybody listening might be clear on AUC. What is AUC, and does our user's guide tell people about that?
So I think we do have a user's guide telling people about the ROC curve, receiver operator characteristic curve, which is basically when you have a test that has a continuous measure and you're not sure where to set the threshold for calling a positive or a negative test. And basically what the ROC score does is plot sensitivity versus 1- specificity at the various thresholds that are possible. And obviously a perfect test, a perfect threshold would have a sensitivity of 100% and a specificity of 100%. So the closer we come to that, the better that test is. But the area under that ROC curve is a reflection of the predictive ability of the test. So usually an AUC of 0.5 means you're no better than the flip of a coin at predicting whether somebody's going to have disease. And an AUC of 1 is the perfect test where you're 100% accurate. And to be clinically useful, an AUC has to be around 0.75, 0.8 to start making a difference clinically.
So from what you said, AUC is one of the ways of judging the value of the additional predictive power of a genetic test. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And from what you said, sometimes it doesn't work out that well.
Most of the time it doesn't work out that well. We find that these polygenic risk scores only add a tiny bit to the AUC.
Well, so let me be somewhat challengingly cynical and say what this user's guide is about is to tell clinicians they shouldn't worry too much about genetic association studies, because seldom do they show anything useful for clinicians. They may be useful to investigators, but clinicians don't worry about it. Is that too cynical a stance?
It might be a bit too wide a net to cast. There are particular circumstances where the genetic associations are particularly strong, and one area is pharmacogenomics. So there have been adverse drug reactions. I'm trying to remember the one you get with antibiotics, fluclox acillin, Stevens-Johnson.
Right.
I think that's the one. So people have done genome-wide association studies of that one, or liver toxicity with some of the antibiotics, and they do find some incredibly strong genetic hits that predict whether somebody will have that kind of reaction. And the odds ratios there are anywhere between 8 and 20. So those are particularly strong genetic effects that are worth worrying about, and those are strong enough that genotyping people can make a difference clinically. So before you use, there's some examples with chemotherapy agents where you have severe bone marrow toxicity if you have a particular genotype. And so in those kinds of setting, it is already coming into clinical practice. So don't ignore the field completely.
Right.
There are some practical applications.
And the user's guide highlights the distinction between when it's practical and when it is not.
Yes.
So if you were trying to sell, say, to a clinician, yes, you should read this user's guide, tell me the sales pitch.
What would I say? Well, I guess the whole way medicine is moving towards precision medicine, genetics will be a large part of that. And understanding what is meant by a SNP, an allele, a polygenic risk score, I think all of this will become part of the vocabulary, the common vocabulary of medicine in the next 10 years. So I'd encourage people to at least start becoming familiar with the terms and starting to look at the studies for that reason. I think my personal skepticism is that the proponents of precision medicine focus mainly on the genetics. And of course, you get your genes at birth. And if you look at nothing else, it basically says that the rest of your life can be predicted from what you're given at birth. And I don't think that's reasonable. I think the advances will come when we combine the genetics with the environmental factors, because it doesn't make sense to me to try and predict disease risk without taking into account some environmental factors.
So there have been lots of guides for using genetic studies. Our user's guide is far from the only one. Is there anything that makes our user's guides for genetic studies special?
I'd like to think it's the clarity and the distillation of what is absolutely essential for validity in these studies.
And you've also said that part of the reason people might read them is just to become familiar with the basic terms. Anything special about our user's guides in that way?
Yes, so the big thing I think we've done differently is that we've published the user's guide to the genetic literature in three parts, and the first part is devoted entirely to clarifying terminology that people will see, and it's basically a refresher or a primer on genetics, and that people might find quite useful.
Yeah, I'm going to push you a little farther in that, because if I remember correctly, at the end of what we did initially, you said, there's nothing like this out there. This is different. Do you still feel that way? And if so, can you elaborate?
I think this is still the only one that I know about that is specifically geared to clinicians, and that starts from the assumption of no knowledge in genetics. And we take people through the basic concepts, the biology of genetics, the terms, how to read the study, and what practical implications there might be for clinical practice. I still have not seen a series do that whole spectrum in the same way we have.
Yeah, I think that's very important. So, John, I've asked you a bunch of questions to describe our user's guides, and you've given some very interesting perspectives in the field in general. Anything else you want to add or comment or reflect on?
I guess the next big area that I think will potentially impact medicine, but it might still be a few years away, is the whole field of epigenomics. The idea that our environment, what we eat, whether we smoke, whether we drink, affects the epigenome, which is the methylation or the acetylation of our DNA. And that almost like leaves a blueprint of our environmental history on our DNA. That might be one way in which the genes and the environment are brought together to allow better prognosis in medicine. But I think that is still many years away.
So do you foresee a major revision of this user's guide to deal with those sort of issues?
I think it's still a few years away, but yes, I'd be happy to collaborate with you again on an updated version that includes epigenomics. But I think we're still a few years away from that.
Okay, so part four of the user's guides remains as a vision for the future.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you, John. That was just great. It was great that you showed us what the user's guide did and showed us the limitations of the genetic association studies and their potential in the future, and how, in particular, the user's guide can introduce clinicians to this whole area of genetic association studies. For further content on user's guides to the medical literature and applying evidence-based medicine to clinical practice, please go to jamaevidence.com.